Ago, the NBA's marquee franchise had a season for the ages that resulted in another banner raised to the historic rafters in the Boston Garden. Hello, everyone. I am Abby Chin, and welcome to episode one of the 86 Celtics interviews. During this series of podcasts, we'll bring you expanded interviews collected during the making of CSN's documentary on the 86 Celtics. Look for new episodes every Tuesday and Thursday on CSNNE.com or by subscribing to iTunes or any other podcast app. In this episode, we talk to one of the members of the Big Three, NBA Hall of Famer Kevin McHale. In this first segment, McHale reflects back on how he came to the Boston Celtics, which is regarded as one of the best trades in the history of professional sports. The legendary Red Auerbach was able to acquire the third overall pick from the Golden State Warriors and Robert Parrish in exchange for the first and 13th picks. The Warriors selected Joe Barry Carroll and Ricky Brown, while Boston drafted McHale.
Well, you know, Boston had the number one pick, and so they had, you know, I knew that Red had come see me play in college, but I hadn't had really a lot of contact with him. And so I was really looking at, you know, Golden State at third. I think there was a Chicago, a Denver, fourth and fifth, or fifth and fourth, and somewhere in there like that. So I was kind of looking at these teams, and Utah was number two. And they had all contacted me and, you know, phone interviews and talked much different than it is today. And, you know, they look under the hood a little differently. And back then it wasn't as much. And the Golden State people came out to visit me in Minnesota. So Golden State wasn't a good team. Utah really wasn't a good team. You know, Denver, Chicago, these weren't good teams. And so I go to New York for the draft, and I'm in my hotel room, and my phone rings. I'm like, I don't even know if anybody knows I'm in New York. So I answer the phone, and it was Red. And Red said, we just traded with Golden State. We're bringing in Robert Parrish. We have like a 12th or 13th pick. We're throwing that at him, but I'm gonna take you at three. And all of a sudden, I go, ooh, they won 60 games last year. Like, you know, wow, this is, you know, Larry Bird's on the team, you know, Dave Collins, Tiny Archibald, Pete Maravich. I mean, there were guys that I kind of idolized on that team. Not Larry, because Larry was just younger, but Dave and Tiny and I mean, I was just like, oh man, you know, this is fantastic. And about 10 minutes later, the phone rings and it's Frank Layden from Utah. And I'm thinking, oh no, like, you know, what is this? And Frank called up, you know, and just said, hey, I just wanted to let you know that we'll be taking Darryl Griffith, the number two pick. And I was like, oh, thank goodness. And so that was the first time I kind of knew, but I got off then everything's a whirlwind. The next day you get drafted and literally, you know, got on a plane. They said, the PR guy said, come on, we're going to Boston. So, you know, they had the shuttles back then, like literally just run on a shuttle, you know, get in there. We take off and we land. I'm like, where's this place? Next door? I mean, I my geography, I knew it was close. I didn't think it was that close. I was like, dang, like, what are we, a suburb of New York? And I got up here and it was just crazy. You know, just that whole 2-day period to become a Celtic was nuts. Early on, even in 81, it was kind of the big four. You know, Max was part of that. So we just had, with one substitution, if I came in for like Larry, we had Max and I and Robert. We were big, you know, Larry's a big guy anyways, but we were big across line. If I came in for Robert, we got really small and we ran and everybody passed. And so with one substitution, you changed the complexion of the team a lot. And, you know, we all fit well together, Robert and I and Larry. Then, you know, Max left and Robert and I and Larry just started playing, and it was a pretty seamless fit. It just, you know, Robert was so dependable, did his thing every single night. You know, Larry was the best player of us three, and just could do everything. And so it was very easy to fit in there. And you know, people have always asked, well, did you sacrifice a lot? No, I don't think anybody really. We won. If Robert had it going, Robert got more shots. If I got it going, I had more shots. If Larry got it going, you know, there was just a real easy fit with us three and how we played and how we complemented each other. And There was no strain in the relationship. There was no strain in anything. It was just a very easy. We enjoyed playing together. We won a lot of games, and it was very easy to play with each other. I think sometimes, when you try to put the pieces together, they don't quite fit. So it's the square peg, round hole. People just try to make it fit. That was round hole, round peg. It just fit in easily. And there wasn't a whole lot of thought going into it. We just played. Well, we'd won in 81. We were a good team. 84, Casey takes over. We have a really good, regular season. We're excited. Get in the playoffs. Have a couple tough playoff series, but you play the Lakers. And, I tell everybody now, there was a heated rivalry, but that doesn't mean that those guys weren't talented. It wasn't like we were playing a bunch of plumbers. I mean, Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, these guys are great players. And they were every bit as good as we were, just kind of, And the game was getting up and down. They were running. It was just kind of, we ran a lot. But against those guys, running was dangerous against the Showtime team. And so we were having to slow things down. And finally, after... they had gotten up on us 2-1 in the series, and Casey had said, no more layups, and Kurt Rambis happened to be the guy coming to the hole, and some guy fouled him hard, and then it started a brouhaha of Larry going nose to nose with Kareem, and it just kind of the whole thing exploded into our kind of game where it was down and dirty, grabbing, holding, fist fighting. We could play that way. We could also play up and down. But we kind of got into that game, and we scratched out a championship in 84 against that team. But that, was, we could play both ways, and I knew we could. We had a really gritty group of guys that liked to play up and down, but when it got nasty, we were all like, we're okay with that. And so that was, the start, and then we lose to 85 to the same team, and I was very disappointed that we didn't get them in 86. I really wanted a piece of those guys in 86.
While the Celtics got the best of the Lakers in 1984, a finals rematch the following season went to L.A.
Well, Max had gotten hurt, and he really wasn't able to play. Larry had hurt his elbow a little bit and was going through his elbow was really bothering him. And we weren't on top of our game. We were good enough, but if you weren't on top of your game against those guys, they'd beat you. They were just better than we were that 2 week period. I mean, there's nothing else to say. I mean, we fought hard. We went out there. We didn't play particularly well. We stayed in games. We found a way to kind of grind it out. But at the end of the day, they just had too much Kareem, too much Magic, and too much Worthy in those guys. And they played better than we did. And it wasn't, it was frustrating. It happened at home. We were a very good home team, and we thought we had chances, but that was just we weren't really at the top of our game for some different reasons. They were just better.
After the loss to the Lakers in the 1985 finals, the Celtics made a major change to their bench, trading Cedric Maxwell to the Clippers for Bill Walton.
Max was a very good friend of mine, so that was kind of hard. Max and I had condos right next to each other, and I always loved Max. He was just, to this day, Cornbread's like one, just he's a great guy. We had won so many big games together, and it was fun. They went out and got Bill, and Bill, for some of us guys, I think Larry, myself, Danny, some of the guys, Bill was kind of a bigger than life guy. I mean, you go back to his UCLA days. I mean, he's getting arrested for protesting and stuff. I mean, I said Patty Hearst stuff. I mean, there was just always some bizarre things. Then you add on top the fact that he has like an unbelievably historic game against Memphis where he's 21 for 22 in the NCAAs and winning the 77 championship in Portland, where that Portland team just with all the passing and movement. So he's coming in. But, you don't know if he's healthy or not. There's a lot of questions. And, camp starts, and immediately Bill is just willing to do any role. The guy is just 100% vested in trying to win a championship. That is just all he talks about is just winning. And there's a joy about him of playing basketball with a group of guys that can really play. and get along, and just there's just no agendas. We just want to win. And Bill might have been the most bought-in teammate you've ever seen in your life. I mean, he was 100% bought in right away. And at first I was like, oh, this guy can't be for real. This has got to be, you know, where's the hippie dude, man? Where's the dude getting arrested in UCLA and you know, protesting everything? But the more you got to be around him, I think we all just, you know, fell in love with his genuine love of winning and team first and all those things. And so he ended up taking a group of guys that was very, very tight and kind of even brought us even tighter. I'm trying to think of my favorite Bill Walton moment. There's so many of them. I mean, you know, Bill just going, do you want to go to a Grateful Dead concert? And I think we were, I don't even know, we might have been on the road, we might have been here. It doesn't matter because Bill was the same way anywhere. We pulled up to the arena and Bill Walton walks to the back door. We have no tickets, we have nothing. And some guy opens the door, doesn't anything, he goes, Bill Walton, I'm with the band. And he just walks in and he goes, and they're with me. And there's like five of us and we just walk in. We pull in and he just, back then everybody had backstage passes, no backstage passes. Bill goes, where's the band? And like these people are there. And all of a sudden, of course, someone recognizes, oh, Bill's here. Well, we go to a room and next thing you know, Jerry Garcia walks in, the entire band walks in and Bill's there and they can't start the concert until they get a chance to talk to Bill. The promoter's like going, you know, we're supposed to go out at 7:30, now it's 7:40 and they're going like Bill's here. We haven't seen him. Like, you know, how can we start the concert till we have enough time to talk to Bill? And then it's 8 o'clock, the promoter is going like we're a half hour late and they're going, we're not done talking with Bill yet. And Bill's introducing people and he's like, it's like old home week with the guy. It's like 8:15 and the promoter's just begging them to go out, like, you know, oh my God, you know, I think it was in Worcester. And he's like, you guys have got to go out there. It's like 8:15, the show's like an hour late. So, okay, we have no tickets yet. And so the show, they get ready to go, and Phil Lesh says, come on. So I'm just walking with Phil Lesh, going, hang on, I guess I'm going where he's going. I have no idea where we're going to sit. They have a couch on the side of the stage. And as I'm sitting there, Phil says, do you play any instruments, Kev, or anything? And I'm like, no. He goes, if you want to join us, just join us. Don't worry about it. And they have a cooler there. We're having a beer. We're watching the concert. And Jerry Garcia gets up there and he says, sorry, we're late, but our old friend Bill Walton came. And of course we couldn't come. And the place just starts cheering like, well, of course you couldn't because you had to hang out with Bill for a while. It was just amazing. And then we sat on stage for the concert and those guys were like 5 feet from us. And I looked at Bill and I go, boy, you are something. And I, you know, just no tickets, no nothing. Ended up on the stage and caused the Grateful Dead to be an hour late. And it was just, that honestly was a typical day in the life of Bill Walton. And when you got to hang around with Bill, you saw and did a lot of interesting things. And that was part of it. But that was just, like I say, that was my introduction to Bill and the Grateful Dead. And I just remember just sitting there thinking, wow, this guy's a piece of work.
When a team like the Celtics of the 80s is constructed of veteran all-star caliber players, it can be a battle for leadership. Mikhail, though, says that was never the case within the Big Three.
You know, I don't think any of us thought about leading the team, and actually I never really thought about that until, you know, later on when I had some teammates say, like, man, like when you guys got, like, pissed and were ready to go, they all were like, ooh. Wait till you see this tonight. You're just competitive. You're playing. I never thought about leading anybody. I think we all had a lot of fun together. And I don't ever remember, you know, giving inspirational speeches. That we didn't do that stuff. We just got like, man, we were ready to go. And if something happened at halftime, you walked in and you could just see on people's faces like, all right, man, it's on now. Let's go get them. And I think most of it was just our body language and how we came out there ready to play. And you know, Larry was very quiet. Larry didn't say a whole bunch of stuff, but boy, you could tell when he was pissed and he was ready to go to work. Believe me, it showed. And Larry was, you know, Larry, people think Larry's just all business. And all. Larry's a fun-loving guy. I mean, we had a good group of guys that liked to laugh, and you know, we had fun. Robert has a great sense of humor. You know, Robert's a great guy, and everybody saw Chief as stoic and this and that. You know, when we were together, we just had a lot of fun. So it was just an easy fit. But we all of us had a very, very competitive, serious side that when you tapped into that, and as I said, you know, to be a championship caliber player, if you're playing against bad teams and the level does this, you play with them, you're better than they do. You're playing against championship caliber players. I mean, you know, honestly, you're talking about Magic and, you know, Worthy, you know, Kareem. Those guys are generational players. When Kareem went to here, you had better be able to go to here. And if you couldn't, if you hung out here, you were going to get run over. And we all had the ability to take it up. And I think we all knew we had that ability to take it up inside of us. So we were never overwhelmed as a group. We looked at it and said, all right, man, let's go. And it was just a fun group that way, because there was supreme confidence that as the game, hey, if you had to hit a 98 mile an hour fastball, you hit it. If it went to 105, you hit it. The guy's throwing 110, you had to hit it. Striking out wasn't an option, so you just had to keep amping it up. And everybody had that ability, and it was never talked about. But we just look. I never thought the game was going to get too big for Larry. I never thought the game was going to get too big for Robert. I never thought there was a moment too big for us. Like, we just said, hey, man, this is what we got to do. Let's go do it.
Beyond the strong bond between the Big Three, the rest of the roster played a huge part in the success of the 80s Celtics. One of the most important pieces, of course, was current Celtics president of basketball operations, Danny Ainge, who Mikhail was very close to.
He was ultra competitive, and you know, that showed right away. And the fact that Danny made an all-star team as a fourth option on a team is amazing. I mean, who does that? I mean, you just never see that. He was a great player, and he was a great player at BYU, and he came here on a team that had a lot of really good players, and he kind of morphed and adapted his game as much as anybody had to change from what he had done in BYU, which was, you know, I mean, he was led the world in scoring. I mean, he was just an unbelievable scorer. He came here, but he is another guy. Let me tell you, the game never got too big for Danny. Danny was one of those guys that when they got amped up, man, he had a competitive nature in him that was really second to none. And everybody saw it. And there were just no quitting that guy. I mean, I noticed that really early. He just went, like, we'd play one-on-one, we'd do things. And his competitiveness, I just enjoyed it because it was really fun to beat him and then tell him I kicked his ass. And it bothered him. And it wasn't fun to beat people that it didn't bother. It was really fun to beat people that it really bothered. And we would play all kinds of games. Like, I remember one day Larry and I were trying to strike him out. We had tennis balls, and, you know, Larry's like, you can't play baseball. So there was a baseball bat at Hellenic College. We were throwing, I mean, we just did stuff all the time. And, you know, we always were just challenging each other. Like, you know, Mike Smith came to our team, and he said, who can stand under the basket and hit the other square with a basketball? Well, we would all do that for a while, like, you know, and Danny could do any of that stuff. I used to race Danny, and I always say, okay, I'm going to get a lead, like, halfway up to the free throw line. Then we just would race, like, down and back. We just did all kinds of crazy things, but, you know, like, the guy was a phenomenal athlete. And so, and he rode everybody, and he gave everybody crap all the time, and he was just a fun-loving guy. And Danny's personality was huge for that team because, like, he just... We had a bunch of guys, and I always said, Danny got to that point, too. When it got nasty, boy, I tell you what, everybody, we had a flat-line team. Like, you'd walk in our huddle, and you couldn't tell if we were up one or up 30. It just, like, everybody just was just, it was quiet. We kind of sat there. We were just, everybody was like, all right, let's go. And, again, DJ was the same way. Never thought, well, the game's going to get too big for DJs. Danny's line to DJ always was, DJ, pretend like this is a really big game so we can win early and we can all get rest. Because DJ was so good in big games. And Danny would go, just trick yourself, please, you know. And, but, like I say, all that whole group of guys had different levels they could access. And Danny was part of it. And he was just, you know, Danny was Danny. And I've said this before. Larry was going to be Larry no matter who was. Danny was Danny. You know, Robert was just going to be. We all had our own personalities, and nobody was putting on airs for anybody. Everybody was just who they were, and it just fit. And it was really, really fun. And Danny's personality, his competitiveness, his talent, his, like I say, his willingness to just take it to whatever level had to be taken to, that, you know, actually, you take all that for granted because you're all around each other, but you're looking back on it, what a unique group of guys that we had that were just we all just fit together, and you throw Bill in there and Scotty Wedman. There were nights where Wedman and Seasting and Walton and Gray K, they would go out there and play better than we did. You know, like we'd be on the bench like, dang, we got to amp this up a little bit. You know, we used to call them the green team, or as Larry said, the scrubs, are doing much better than we are. And like, you know, and we all pushed each other. But all those guys had the ability to play well on demand, and that's what the NBA is. It's you got to play on demand. Like, you can play three really bad teams, and Tuesday, Wednesday, you know, Friday, and Saturday night's a really good team. It's your fourth game in 5 nights. Well, the schedule maker doesn't care about that. The other team doesn't care about that. You got to be on demand that night, and you got to bring your best. And it's an on-demand league, and we had a bunch of on-demand players. You'd kind of come in, and I would literally go like, okay, today, I'm just gonna smooth through practice. Because Casey was really good about, if you said, hey, Case, man, I'm a little bit tired. Okay, we're gonna work on this. And so you got into practice, and pretty soon you got going, and then Greg Kite would run into you and hit you. Then you'd be like, and then the green team would start talking trash about winning a game. Then we'd say, all right, man, play another game. And then eventually you just amped it up. And as Bill used to like to say, well, let's let them win once we can go home. Like we weren't going to stop practice until he said the white team, or he's called it the stat team, until the stat team won. And he used to just argue every call with Jimmy Rogers and Chris Ford, or as he called them, Chris Rogers and Jimmy Ford. They're the same guy. They just make the worst calls. And it just at some point it got amped up where we all really got after it in practice. And I can promise you, I never went into a practice like saying, I'm going to get amped up today for practice. You had played 40 minutes the night before. But there was just so much competitiveness and so much trash being talked. At a certain point, you went like, you forgot that you were tired. You forgot about everything. You just went out there and competed. And it was fun. It was really a ball. And the days I really remember is like we'd have a day off, and then we'd come in, and then the white team would start. We didn't start talking trash anymore. We were tired. But boy, we had a day off, we'd come in, we'd just go like, oh, we're going to obliterate you guys today. And we would just pound them into submission because we were all ready to go. And their best chance of beating us was when we played 40 minutes the night before. But, it was fun. Our games, we couldn't wait to get through doing some drill work so we could get to scrimmaging. And like everybody would just be yelling, Case, let's scrimmage, let's quit doing this. We just wanted to play them. And it was really fun. We were all a bunch of self-motivated guys. So Case, when Case got mad, you literally just like, when Case would come in and, yell and curse, we'd all go, ooh, man, we must have really crossed over a bad bridge to get Case that mad. Because Case was very calm. And he didn't do it very often. But boy, when he did, he got our attention. Case knew he had a bunch of guys that were very self-motivated, that were had very high basketball IQs. Case was great at asking, what do you guys see? What do you want to do? Case would always come up to me and say, okay, you're guarding this guy tonight. We're probably heavy on this guy. I guarded a lot of different people. And he'd always say, well, what do you think? What do you want to do? And he was great at saying, okay, look, let's start off here. And if you're not comfortable, we'll go to some of your suggestions. And he gave you a lot, and I think he got it from Red. He gave you a ton of responsibility and a ton of authority so that if I said we were going to do something, I was damn sure to make that could work because it was my suggestion in front of the team. And you had a bunch of guys that were responsible. Larry was a great team defender. Robert was just dependable. Robert was in the back of that line, blocking shots, doing his thing, talking. He was a great team defender. Larry, like if you're playing Dominique and I said, okay, I'm gonna force some lefties into spin back right, Larry said, I'll be there, man. He was there to steal the ball. He just came there. We were really in tune as a group. So Casey knew how to manage a bunch of guys like we were ultra competitive, highly, and he at times would get mad at us and stuff, but he was a great guy for that group, and I think he really understood us all. And I can speak for me because, Bill came in late and some guys didn't. We had Bill Fitch here, and Bill was a hard charger. Bill was a very, very good coach, but really a hard charging guy that jumped your ass a lot. So after games, Case was assistant coach. Case would always say, hey, find me, stop by in the bar, I'll buy you a drink, whatever, after the game. So I'd go in there, and it would be Cousy and Heinsohn and Casey. And come on now. I mean, there's like 30 rings there with those guys. And you'd come in, and Case would always say, okay, Bill's going to make you a better player. You just, this is what he's trying to get out of you, you know. And he always, and when you left those times with Casey and his buddies, Kuz and Tommy, you felt better because they would say, hey, you do this really well, rookie boy. I tell you what, you're going to be a great player. And, you know, you don't know how good you're going to be, and you don't know. But they had seen it before, guys developing and getting better. And they were, he was so supportive that I know for me, we were very good friends. And so playing for Case was really easy and smooth. And it was like playing, like I said, it was like playing for a very, very good friend and a guy that you really respected. And, you know, the stories of Casey guarding people and Sam Jones would be there. And they all told these stories of just unbelievable success. And you looked at them like, wow, they seem like regular guys. But in the heat of the moment, they all did just did spectacular things. And being around them, just there was just a vibe that, you know, just unique to the Celtics at that time. Because who the hell has been on teams where they won 10, you know, did what Russell did what the Jones boys did all that stuff. And they lived it. And so being around Case was just, I just enjoyed him so much. So for me, it was just a joy to be coached by a guy who I really respected a lot and liked a lot.
As the NBA evolves year after year, anytime a player with a low post game comes into the league, he's inevitably compared to Kevin McHale. In this clip, McHale talks about where his wide array of low post moves came from.
As I got in the NBA, that thing just started developing more. I really came in and Bill Fitch used to say you have to have a basic. And I really had a nice little jump hook. So a right-handed jump hook, and I would shoot, come over to my left shoulder, and I'd shoot that jump hook, and I shot thousands and thousands of them. It got to the point of where, you know, when I played, if I could clear my shoulder, I was shocked if it didn't go in. Like, if it didn't go in, I wanted to have the ball checked. I'd be like, wait, there's something wrong with that ball. You know, that thing's got to go in. And so you had so much confidence in that. I always had a little turnaround fadeaway. And from there, it was just pump fakes off that. And you played against the same guys all the time. Like, if you did the same shot against Robert all the time, believe me, Robert is a world-class defender. You know, Max was a really good defender. You know, ML Carr, we'd play one-on-one and do stuff. So you're always tricking each other and doing things and expanding your repertoire. But I worked at all those things and just became very comfortable down there and just got better and better. And as the confidence grew and you understood the game more, those guys were right. They said, you know, you're going to be a very, very good player. But, you know, in yourself sometimes you don't see it. But I think midway through my second year, I said, you know what? There's not a guy in this league I can't play against. There's not a guy. You know, you start gaining confidence and stuff. And then it just grows from there. But it was, I worked at it a lot. And, you know, and I never, you know, I people that I was, what do you do? I said, I don't work at basketball. I just was like, you know, I just show up and play. And that, it couldn't be farther from the truth. I did all this work and stuff. But I never wanted to tell anybody what the hell I did. I figured if they couldn't figure it out, then good for me.
The 1986 Celtics are widely regarded as one of the best teams in NBA history. But the season didn't start off smoothly, as a loss to the New Jersey Nets on opening night produced a memorable speech from newcomer Bill Walton.
I remember Larry taking off his shoes, Bill standing up and go, I would like to apologize to everybody who ever put on a Celtic uniform. You know, started off with this thing. I remember Larry like getting about halfway through his shoe and Bill did this whole thing and he goes, I sure as hell hope we play better because I can't stand listening to that 81 more times. And we all just started laughing. And I went, boy, I hear you. You know, Bill was so sincere and literally just was like, you know, hey, it's one game, man. Let's not play like that because I can't stand to hear that speech every night. And I remember just laughing and going, oh, God, what a bad game, you know. New group of guys, one of 82. Just, you know, it was a bad game. We did everything. We were a team that always found ways to win. It was so different. And the reason I remember that game is that we did everything we could to lose, which was weird. We missed free throws when we didn't need to. We had turnovers at clutch times. We didn't guard the right guys. We left open guys. We left good shooters open. We usually left bad shooters open. You know, we did everything wrong. And we were all just like, you know, it was the first game we won the finals in 84. We had lost in 85 to the Lakers. First game of the season, and I think with that team, it just took a little while for us all to kind of catch the right groove and to catch everything. And that was, but I just remember going like, wow, what a weird game for us to play. It was just like we were completely out of sorts and stuff like that. But not concerned because we had always won and I knew we'd win and we had Larry Bird, so that always helped. And but I remember Bill's speech and I just remember Larry's comment. And I remember like someone threw me a beer. I think I had a beer. I was like, oh, what a lousy game. And we just kind of moved on from there.
Despite a 21-6 record heading into a nationally televised game on Christmas Day against the Knicks in New York City, the 86 Celtics weren't playing as well as many people expected. McHale made a personal decision not to travel with the team per league rules.
Yeah, I took the plane down, actually. I didn't take the train. I took a plane. I just made the decision. They said, well, come down the night before to New York. And I just said, well, I want to wake up and have Christmas with my family. Kids are opening up the presents. They were young. And I went like, I'm gonna come down on a plane. And so I got there, and I think Case must have heard, or someone must have heard I came. And they said, did you? I said, no, I came down this morning. And you know, they weren't all that happy about it. We played another game where we had a lead, I think, and just some bizarre stuff. We ended up losing. And you know, I wasn't apologetic about it. I'd do it again if I had to do it. You know, if I had to do it again, I'd do it again. I mean, I just thought, well. I don't remember. I think it was like a 5 o'clock game or a 4, whatever it was. You know, I could get down there in time and stuff. And, you know, I don't. You know, I remember Red like 5 days later came up to me because they said they were going to find me and stuff. You know, and I broke a rule. I mean, they wanted us down the night before. I had no problem with that. And he came up to me and he said, "We're not going to find you. I'd probably stay home with my family too. Don't worry about it." And I just kind of laughed about it. And we moved on. And but I think that was a game where it was kind of we lost, and at that point, I think, you know, we had played okay for the first 5-6 weeks of the season, but we hadn't hit stride at all. Boy, after that, we started hitting stride, and I mean, this, you could just feel it when you walked in the games. You could just feel it during the games that, man, we started hitting our stride, and the stride was one level higher than most teams I had been on, and it was really fun. Well, I just remember they said we're not going to drink till we win a championship, and all I asked was, I hope we're planning on winning it this year because I will break my vow if it goes longer than this June. And I remember going like, I'm not sure that's going to help us play, but if everybody does it, I guess I'm in. And you know, I thought it was way later in the season than that, but it probably was about that time. And I don't want people to think that the beer pack got us playing better. I think we had a lot of stuff that led into that, and. You know, for a bunch of guys that like to have a few beers after the game and BS and stuff like that, we decided not to. And someone said, I don't remember whose idea it was, honestly. Someone said it was Larry's idea. I can assure you it wasn't Larry's idea. Of all the things I can assure you of, it wasn't Larry Bird's idea. Somehow he went along with it, which was very un-Larry-like. But yeah, we kind of did that and I don't know. It was just, you know, for Danny, it was easy. He was a Mormon. I said, well, hell, you're not giving up anything. I said, you give up something. It was just one of those things that we did. I don't remember why exactly we did. Maybe we had a big New Year's night and we decided that we all came to practice hungover. I don't know. But we just decided to do it. And, you know, believe me, we made up for it the night that we won the championship. We all made up for a lot of lost time that night. There might have been a few hall passes to maybe escape the non-beer thing, and maybe like Bill and I might have made a small exception every once in a while. And I pretty much can guarantee you, when Larry's buddies came from Indiana, that there were some exceptions to the rule. But as a group, we didn't go out as much and party. But yeah, we went to Bill's house, and I'm sure we all had a few beers, and you know, we. But I think we found a way to sneak around that rule every once in a while. But as a team, like, we didn't go out and, like, after games, we would normally sit in the locker. You know, one of my favorite memories is that we were playing in Atlanta. This is my first year. I'm in the NBA. I'm just excited to be in the NBA. I think, you know, people are paying you money to play basketball. Like, are you kidding me? I played for free my whole life. I'm just thinking, you know, playing on a team, we're really good. We're winning games. And Larry and I are we stay at the Omni Hotel, so we played at the Omni Arena. It was walking distance. We walked to the game. We just literally came down the elevator and walked over there. So the game ends. There's no bus to catch, and there's a cooler beer there. And Larry, I got ice bag on my leg, and Larry's got an ice bag, and I said, "Throw me a beer, Birdie." And so we're sitting there, and Larry looks at me, and he, you know, typical Larry, you know, he just goes, "Shit, Kev, can you believe they pay us to do this?" And as we're drinking beer, sitting there, and I go, "I was just thinking the same thing." I said, "Can you believe this? We're sitting here, got free beer, we're icing our knees, we got nowhere to go, we won a game." And it was like amazing that people were paying you to do this. It was like a dream come true. And on that 86 team, it was so much fun that they were actually like paying us to go out and just have a ball playing basketball. It was just so much fun. And it was just an unreal experience. So going over to Bill's house and having a fun that day, we had fun all the time. That was a typical day for the 86 Celtics.
A big part of the greatness of the 86 Celtics was their complete dominance in the Boston Garden. Including the playoffs, the team went 50-1 in their own building. Here's Mikhail on what made the Celtics so unbeatable in Boston.
We had an unbelievable amount of confidence that the outcome of the game was going to be in our favor, no matter where we played. But when we stepped on the floor at home, there was just an expectation level of winning. There wasn't any, you know, it was just like such a high expectation level that we were just going to find a way to get the job done. I don't know. I actually, it was years later when someone asked me, you know, "Did you guys win 40-1? And I said, "Yeah, I think the next year we went like 39-2 or something like that." So I was like, "Yeah, we didn't lose at home very much during that stretch. I mean, we just won a lot." And they were amazed. And I'm like, once I got into management and coaching and stuff, I was like, "How the hell did we go 40-1? I mean, that because you play so many different games, you're traveling back. You know, we might have played that, you know, on a Tuesday night in Atlanta. We fly back in the morning. We all go home, catch an hour's nap, come back and beat, you know, the Knicks Wednesday night or beat whoever you played. And there was just an expectation level that we weren't going to lose. I just think you had a bunch of guys with a supreme amount of confidence and that we were just going to get the job done. And I, you know, the fans were great. I love the fans. But I honestly believe that team would have done really well if there wasn't a fan. Like, once the ball got thrown up, if there wasn't a fan in the stands, would have been just like practice. When the first time that guy hit you, you'd have said, "All right, it's on now. And at the end of this thing, we're going to have more points than you do. We're going to beat you." And it was all just about going out and beating somebody. And that team was great at going out and beating people, especially at home.
While things were quote-unquote easy at home for the 86 Celtics, traveling was an entirely different process for NBA teams. These were the times of commercial flights. There was no team charter planes, which meant longer days and nights during the grueling NBA schedule.
No, it's completely different. I mean, you know, we'd have the first flight out in the morning, and then you'd play. And by the time that you had dinner or had something, it was 1 o'clock at night. You know, by the time, and you'd have a 5:30 a.m. wake up call, get the first flight out, get into Boston, deal with the Boston traffic on the way home, and you know, maybe get home around 11 o'clock, 11 a.m. You know, noon. Say hi to the family a little bit. Go. I'd always took a little nap and tried to get myself, whether I slept or not, I just kind of really prepped for the game. That was my time when I really started prepping. And then I would get in the car and drive down to the garden. And the whole time I was in there, I played a little music, but I was just focused on what I had to do. So by the time I got to the Boston Garden, I had already kind of replayed the game in my head, who I was guarding, my assignments, all the stuff I had to do. And I was good to go. And it was just a different routine. Now you fly in, hell, sometimes, especially in New England, once we started chartering, we'd be home by midnight. Sometimes from games, and I'd be like, "Wow, what a different deal!" You know, slept the whole night, got up. It was this, you know, the day of travel, commercial travel, was a lot different. Yeah, we did all, but that's just kind of what it was. And as I've said a million different times, we were playing basketball. Now let me tell you something. My father worked in the mines. Okay, that's hard work. We weren't loggers. We weren't out, you know, 9 to 5 in it. We played basketball for a living with a bunch of guys you really enjoyed. You were really good at what you did, and it was really fun. It wasn't hard, you know, to get up for a game. It was actually pretty easy. And I think, as I stated earlier, when Larry and I were sitting at each other, looked at each other, and Larry said, they pay us to do this. And we both went like, I remember thinking, wow. Like, yeah, I never lost that until my last year when I was kind of too beat up to play. that was the first time in my life I ever went to a game, and I was like, oof, this is going to be drudgery trying to get, trying to get healthy. And I knew that that was the end of my career. But prior to that, playing basketball was fun. Let me tell you something. If you ever have all you people out there, if you ever have an opportunity to do something really, really fun for a living and they pay you a lot of money, do it. It's a good gig.
Boston began the 1986 playoffs against the eighth-seeded Chicago Bulls and second-year guard Michael Jordan.
I think they had won 35, 36 games, the Bulls. Michael had broke his foot at some point earlier in the year. He came back, finished the season out, was kind of playing great, but honestly, like, it wasn't like we were looking at the Bulls like they were really going to beat. I mean, we prepped for them, but the prep was pretty much like, well, let's get these guys out of here. Let's just beat them. And so we really weren't double-teaming Mike. We didn't do a lot of schemes on him. We just said, well, this guy can't beat us. Well, I think the first game he had like 40 or something. I mean, a lot. And we're all like, man, this guy can really play. Well, game two ends up being just an epic game. I mean, he had 60?
3 in the second game, 49 in the first.
Is that what it was? Oh, so after the first game, we're like, man, that dude can really play. After the second game, we're like, oh my word. I mean, this guy's the real deal. And in the third game, we doubled him. We did so many. I don't remember his statistics. You should look it up. But it was completely, like, we went in there, we're like, okay, man, let's get these guys out of here. Let's double them. Let's do, we really got into scheming and doing all the stuff that we had did. That we normally did against great players, we kind of, we just were like, hey, we'll switch on them and, we'll let them shoot. That was the start of Michael Jordan becoming Michael Jordan. But again, I will tell you, there was never even a doubt that we were going to beat him. I mean, I was just like, I was kind of surprised. I was like, oh man, we're going to have to go to overtime to beat these dudes. But I never thought that there was any chance they had of beating us, one game, much less two or three. And look up the third game stats. You can report them later. We shut them down. We kind of crushed them in Chicago that third game. But it was eye opening for all of us, like how good that guy was going to be. But we probably took them for granted a little bit, and probably took him for granted a little bit. But it was the start of Michael Jordan becoming Michael Jordan. When we played Atlanta, we went up 3-0, and then we lost the fourth game in Atlanta, and they were, talking some smack about, yeah, we weren't going to lose the last game, all this stuff. And so we were all, like, a little irritated, and we should have probably swept them, but we didn't. And we came out, and we put a third quarter on them in game five. That, matter of fact, Danny and I watched that. I came to town, I don't know when it was, but Danny was working for the Celtics, and we kind of watched that quarter, and I was just like, oh my gosh. It was just like I had forgot we had done stuff like that. I mean, I think it was 36-6. It was something ridiculous. I don't even know what it was. But it was such a bum rush that I kind of went like, and at the time I had been coaching and stuff, and I was like, what does Mike Fratello do? He just called a bunch of timeouts. He just ran into a tsunami, and we just wiped him off the face of the earth, went in and looked at Milwaukee and said, let's go, beat them. And was disappointed somewhat that Houston beat the Lakers. I really wanted a piece of the Lakers in 86. But again, never thinking that, honestly, once Houston got there, I never thought for a second that Houston could beat us. Like, I looked at that thing and said, there's just no way. I mean, I knew the Lakers could do this and this and this. I thought Houston could do this. And when we went to here, I was like, man, they're not going to keep on hitting us player for player, play for play, toughness for tough, all that stuff. I just was like, I thought it was just a matter of time. There was an inevitability about that in my mind that we were just going to win. It was just a matter of who it was, and I'd much rather have beaten the Lakers. But Houston was there, so, we were going to beat them. Jerry gets into it with Ralph, and it just Bill's over in the middle of the scrum and all this stuff's going on, and it just was one of those things where it sparked us onto, like, when we came home for game six, I just remember that we were all like pissed off and we were ready to go, and there wasn't even a doubt in my mind that we were going to just trounce them the next night. Like, I just remember just getting that feeling like, this thing's over tomorrow night, and we're going to come out and we're going to hit them with our best shots early. And I'd be shocked if they could remain standing after we hit them with our best shots. Because that year when we hit you with our best shots, you went down. And we started that game off just swinging. And it was just, again, it just felt like a lot of games at the Boston Garden. I know it was for the finals. There was just an inevitability in my mind of what was going to happen. It wasn't even a question. It was just like, we're going to beat these guys. And then we're going to be world champions, and then we're going to be able to drink beer again. And but there was never a doubt in my mind. There was never a doubt in my mind we were going to trounce Atlanta after they had beat us. There was never a doubt in my mind that, you know, we still had some scars from 83 when we lost to Milwaukee. Like, we took it out on people, and it's hard to describe that to people. But believe me, I guess that would just be called supreme confidence. I don't think it was arrogance, but it was just like, we're better than you, and we're just going to show you we're better than you. And it was never a doubt in my mind at all. When I tell you there was a joyousness about that team and how we played and how we got together, and just again having Danny and DJ and Bill and Robert and Larry and Scotty and all these guys that had different levels they could go to, where nothing was too big for that team. Like, you just, whatever you put in front of us, we were going to find a way to get it done. And that develops such a strong bond. And after that, like, I mean, you would literally, you know, if Bill would call you, and my wife Lynn would answer the phone, and she'd say, it's Bill. And I'd say, hello. And he goes, Bill Walton here. He goes, home of the 86 championship Celtics. I was wondering if you'd like to, and I just went, no, you quit calling me. We went out like for 3 nights. I was so tired. Like, I was like, you know, I had nothing left. We partied a lot and we had a lot of fun, but it was just it was the end of an unbelievable, you know, the next year we had injuries and stuff like that. But it was the end of like almost a magical ride of supreme confidence, supreme inevitability that we were going to win, we were going to find a way, and just a group of guys that were really, really tight. And, you know, the best team I ever played on, and by far. And the most fun you could have playing basketball, by far. And the most amount of confidence you could walk into a game that we're getting it done. And, you know, looking at DJ and Danny and those guys and just thinking, they're going to find a way. Like, we're going to find a way. It's just like, it doesn't matter what you throw at us. Throw your best, please, because we like your best, because your best brings out our best. And there was no doubt in my mind that year our best was here and everybody else's best was here. And when we went to our best, it was a thing of beauty. It was the 36-6 run against Atlanta. You can't live at that level because it's impossible to do. But when you know you have access to that level, it's really a special thing. And that, you know, that was what that team was. I would take that 86 team and put it against anybody at any time. I mean, and I'm sure Michael feels that about the 96. And I'm sure that right now the Golden State Warriors, when they do win 73 tonight, which is, by the way, an amazing accomplishment. I mean, that I don't know how they do it just from a concentration standpoint. Like, we lost our concentration, lost the bad teams. Like, Mike Jaminski tortured Bill Walton in New Jersey. When I wore a Mike Jaminski jersey the next day at practice to bust his balls about it. But just the fact that they just maintained that for 73, I'm sure they'd tell you they would win. That team was special in a lot of ways, and eras are different, so it's so hard to say what would happen and stuff. But there's just no doubt when you have teams like that, they believe that no matter what you throw at them, there's a way to overcome that. And no matter where that game goes, you've got another level, and you can get on top of them. And as Bill said, like every once in a while we'd go to 11. And 11's hard to get to, and we wouldn't stop at 10. We had 11. If we had to go, we could go higher. And they believe that. We believe that. It would be fun. It'll never happen. The rules are completely different. Coaching in this era, it is so different than back then. I mean, my gosh, we'd probably all fall out in the first quarter. And if they let us play our rules, those guys would be like, why are they mugging us, and why isn't anybody blowing a whistle? So it is just completely different eras. But I I would, you know, go to my grave telling you that that team wasn't just what it was on the floor. It was a special group of guys with the makeup of just a unique group of guys that just had unbelievable belief in what we were able to do as a group. And, you know, so, you know, I don't know. We'll never play them. They'll never play us. All that stuff will never happen. But I think if you talk to Russ about Russ's best team, they'd say, hey, let's go play. And it would be fun. If you could do that, it would be wonderful. I think if you assembled that team today, okay, and said, okay, go for 74, whatever. I think I again get to the belief that we could accomplish whatever we wanted to accomplish. That team was just unique that way, that we would all hold each other accountable and say, okay, man, we're gonna get to this number. This it's number 75. If that was our goal, we'd have found a way to do it. I mean, and if it was 73, whatever it was, I do believe that team could accomplish it just because it was a unique group of guys that were brought together, and for one magical season, it was just fun. You know, I think if we don't have all the injuries and Lenny Bias, you know, doesn't die and all that stuff, you're just adding another really quality player to an already, you know, historically great team. I think had we all stayed healthy, we'd have been able to, you know, roll off a couple. And just because, like I said, you know, we made it to the finals with broken feet, Bill not playing, run down. On just grit alone. I mean, it was just like, you know, we may have been beat up, but our minds weren't beat up. Our bodies may have been, but we just beat teams on grit alone. And now if you'd add health to that, where we maintained our mental toughness and our mental, hey, we're gonna get this done. And probably playing almost anybody besides the Lakers, we could have pulled it off with injured and beat up, but they were just a very, very good team. But, you know, I don't know what would have happened. All I know is that if you could have kept that same vibe of that team and added Lenny Bias, it would have been, you know, phenomenal. It just wasn't meant to be, though. I guess we had our one, I tell people that our careers then, Larry's two, you know, my foot, Larry's back, everything, we were much more like, you know, now the stars are on, they play for 20 years, we were much more like you know, meteors. We came in, we flamed hard, and we flamed out, but we gave you what we had along the way. It was a good show. Didn't last long, but it was a good show. And I just think had that team been able to, you know, keep everything together, it would have been almost impossible to beat us. Because again, like I said, in 87, we just did what we did on sheer toughness and sheer just, you know what, we're not going to quit, and you're going to have to beat our ass. Because, you know, we may be half of what we were, but that's still good enough to beat you.
In 1986, Kevin McHale made his second NBA All-Star team, was named to the first team All-Defensive team, and averaged 25 points per game during the Celtics championship playoff run. McHale was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in 1999 after his 13-year career all with the Boston Celtics. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of our series on the 86 Celtics. Again, you can subscribe to our iTunes feed by searching CSNNE or by downloading on CSNNE.com. Look for a new episode every Tuesday and Thursday.